Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Those waveforms look a bit bad, don't they? Audacity is updated literally as we sat down to record.
And we've just spent the last half an hour looking at waves as if we were mariners.
Amber Waves of Grey. Amber Waves is a porn star, right?
Sounds like it.
Yeah. Did I just make that? I don't.
To be fair, Amber Waves sounds like something men fear once a month.
We're not allowed to say that. Okay, Clone Saga Chronicles continue.
Enjoy, my favourite part of the show.
Oh, shut your face.
You just assumed that I'm always being sarcastic, though,
when in fact you weren't, because I know that you were chomping at the bit to borrow all these.
Exactly, I am, yeah.
I am in Spider-Man, Ben Reilly, Volume 1, still.
Are we still in 1?
We're still in Volume 1, because I'm going to be brutally honest with you, I've been doing a lot of prep for upcoming shows.
Oh, yeah.
Should we tease?
Tantalize.
Some James Bond shows coming up.
Some James Bond.
Some Hellblazer coming up.
I've got some Dragon Ball coming up.
Yeah. These are all exciting things coming your way, lovely listener.
Coming for the right in your ears.
High price of carries the one, Jack All. So if you want to buy us a coffee, because the coffee fund, suspiciously low this year. And now I know it's a cost of living crisis, but yeah, we appreciate the donations. So if you want to buy us a coffee for all this juicy content,
which is free.
Yeah.
You know, the effort that we go through.
It takes a lot of planning this
year. To give free entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, this bit doesn't take any planning, so I don't do any notes for it. So I am currently reading the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 issues that took place in between Ben Reilly saying, "Yes, Peter, I will take on the mantle of Spider-Man." And Peter saying, "All right, fair play, mate. Me and the missus are going to off and have a baby." Ta-da! 11 issues.
Right.
11 issues.
How many times did he change his mind, though?
Quite a few before he finally... Now, all of this was marketing.
Right.
The Life of Reilly, which is fantastic. I wish they'd do that as a proper book.
Okay.
Instead of just being this online thing. But anyway, Spursley says that they felt they could milk the Scarlet Spider for a short amount of time, and they wanted double this.
Okay.
And the editors and the writers, no, not a chance. I'm going to be honest, I wish they'd stuck to the guns and just said, no, not a chance.
Right.
It's a slog, to be honest with you. I'm not going to lie. I'm finding it very, very hard to care about what goes on in these strips. I'm currently up to Spectacular Scarlet Spider issue 2, which is part 4 of Cyber War.
What's Cyber War?
Oh, well, this is an excellent question. I'm glad you asked. This was the time when the internet was shiny and new.
Oh, right.
Vibrant, exciting new playground from which writers could spin wondrous yarns steeped in real technical scientific knowledge of what the internet was, will be in the future. Right. Is dated as crap nowadays.
Well, that's a very optimistic way to look at something that which is used primarily for porn. And I don't think that would work that well in a Spider-Man story.
Well, if this was an issues of somebody looking
Imagine if this was the same like timeline where Mary Jane was a model and Peter's got to dodge shitty AI versions of Mary Jane porn. You know, that would actually be a realistic Spider-Man story.
That would actually work. And also, you mentioned an AI that I would imagine that we will look back on this current period of everyone being AI as the boogeyman in like 10, 15 years or whatever, in the same way I am looking at these stories now, reading them, going, this isn't how the internet works, guys. But I remember this period, like X-Files did episodes about internet. And what was it? One of the worst episodes of Buffy's first season was about the demon that lived in the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
So it isn't just this comic's fault, I will be brutally honest. But by the end of this issue, look, he finally decides once again, to be Spider-Man.
Right.
And yet, there is then a sensational Spider-Man prelude by Dan Jurgens, which finally leads into Ben Reilly becoming Spider-Man for the first time.
Horrible way to reprint the lenticular cover in the omnibus form.
Yeah, the
why would you
cover
do that?
Yeah.
So to the audiences at home, it looks like the way it's been printed in the omnibus is when you get the lenticular cover at the worst possible angle, so that you do not get a singular image. It is every single image in one.
Yeah, I mean, this was the era of the enhanced cover.
You would have thought they'd learn how to reprint them, though.
Yeah, you'd think they would have given up the lenticular thing, though.
Yeah.
You know, we're paying enough for these things.
Give me the...
So I would have liked them to put the lenticular, though.
Yeah.
But do you remember Eclipso, The Darkness Within, by any chance?
No.
A mini-series. It was the summer crossover that DC did.
Right.
I think it predates you. I think it's like 93, 94-ish.
Right, okay.
So it was before you were born.
Yeah.
And the cover
right.
had Eclipso doing this with his eye.
Okay, right.
And it's got a diamond on it.
Right.
Reflected in his eye.
Okay.
The direct sales edition literally has a diamond.
Right. Did that crash the economy?
No, it's not a real, you know, money diamond.
African mines were going out of business for the PC.
It's got a cheap piece of purple plastic on the cover pretending to be a diamond.
Right, okay. Right?
On the cover.
Right.
So what is going to happen to that when that comic slides into your comic collection?
Yeah, yeah.
Ones in front of it have embedded in it diamond shape. It was a massive mistake.
Yeah.
But if they did that as an omnibus, I would want that.
Well, the cover. I just love lenticular covers because the best thing about them was scratch them and just hear it.
Oh, God, yeah. Did it not? It always made me think of that bit in Jaws. Scratches his nails. I hated that. So I have not yet got to the Dan Jurgens, but I have one more issue of Cyber War to cover. And this, to mean, to be fair, the 11 issues does include an issue of the Green Goblin series.
Just to keep you going, give you a little something.
Where they inadvertently tried to make the Green Goblin a hero for a bit. And it didn't really take, but it was nice, you know, artwork in there from Scott McDaniel. And then later on, we've got another New Warriors issue, Be Still My Heart. And weaving in between him actually becoming Spider-Man, there's another Scarlet Spider two-parter.
Right.
I'm thrilled to see how that runs now that he has actually adopted Spider-Man. But once we get past all that, and then we get a two-part miniseries with the Punisher.
Right.
And then we get a Venom miniseries. But then after that,
right,
we actually get into the meat and potato of Ben Reilly being Spider-Man.
And you're past halfway in the omnibus by that point.
Then a Christmas special. And then a four-issue miniseries about Peter Parker finally and forever walking away, retiring to peace and quiet in the suburbs with his wife and child. And then finally we get into some decent stuff with a couple of annuals at the end. So it's... I mean, I remember the Dan Jurgens stuff and Ben Reilly stuff that Tom DeFalco was doing and all that stuff being good.
Okay, you've got to get to there.
But there's a lot of saga before you get to the clones. Or is there a lot of clones before you get to the... It doesn't matter which way it is. There's an awful lot of wading going on at this point.
Right.
And like we talked about last time, I think somebody should do a novel of it,
okay,
like they did with Nightfall and The Death of and No Man's Land. But it should be somebody with a keen editorial eye who can look at it and go, right, we don't need any of that.
Mm.
Like Minority Report, let's throw all that away and all of that stuff and do it as a streamlined telling of the tale, 300 and odd pages in novel form. Get a decent writer to do it.
See,
with a good editor.
Even if they redid it in comics, you trim the fat, you've got six issues.
Well, I think you may have 12, I mean, to be fair. But yeah, so that's where I'm at with that. And I will continue because I am, you know...
Committed.
I am committed, or should be, to reading more Clone Saga. Should we do an email?
Let's do an email.
Let's do an email before we crack on with today's topic du jour, which is a good one. I'm going to say that. Matt Prather's emailed in. Hello, Michael and Andrew. Hello, Matt. So it's been a while since I last dropped a rambling missive. Sorry. Oh, it's all right. We do rambling missives every month. So you guys covered the only Doom Patrol I have no experience with. So way to pull me back in. I have no idea why, but Doom Patrol has a spot in my heart. It draws me in with a weird concept and I just stick around. Good. Mm-hmm. It was good, wasn't it?
It was good.
Yeah, and the facsimile edition was good.
It was good.
And if they do, you know, these little trades that they're doing now,
yes,
DC Finest.
The tenor ones, yeah.
Yeah, if they do early Doom Patrol, I'll pick one of them up because that omnibus is now a stupid amount of money.
Complete story arcs, aren't they? So
yeah, yeah. So explain to me why Zero Hour's coming out in two parts then.
Zero Hour?
Yes.
That's getting one.
Yes.
Zero Hour's only four issues, isn't it?
Yes, but they're putting the tie-ins in it.
Oh, that's cool. So I might grab that.
They're doing that as a... I think it's a two-parter.
Right.
As DC finds that's been just solicited.
Okay, cool.
And they've solicited a couple like, of just old Justice Society stuff. And
right.
All that
so, movement. Once again, DC have said we're going to streamline our collected editions and then just...
Decided not to.
Yeah.
Because they've just done that when in the same solicitations announcing Absolute Superman.
Oh, are those solicits out now?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
And there is a facsimile of Hawkman with the first appearance of Zatanna.
Oh, okay.
So I may be getting that.
Yeah.
And obviously Crisis. Yeah. Has reached Supergirl's death. Spoilers for a 30-year-old Hulk. Oh, but I love that. That is rapidly. I get my stack of comics, not joy in all of them,
yeah,
to lesser and varying degrees. But the first thing I read every month is that facsimile of Crisis.
Yeah, well, I just got this month's shipment, and I think Dana had three comics, and then I think I had three and four of them. Were facsimiles of something.
It's a sad reflection.
I got the Godzilla facsimile.
I did. I got that too.
Chunky issue.
Yeah.
70% ads.
Yeah, well, it was the 70s. I think you were only getting like 17 or 18 pages of story in the 70s and more adverts.
I was thinking it was, it's quite a chunky one. So I was thinking, oh, it's double sized issue one. And yeah, it's two thirds of it is ads.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good job they got the rights because they foolishly put Marvel characters in that issue.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, we're not. We digress. See, speaking of rambling, Superman as seen through the JMS lens was not bad, Superman. Not great, but it held my interest for three volumes, I guess. Nuff said. Well, that's pretty much where we were. It was fine. The Prisoner was a franchise I never got into. Change that. Having seen only 2.5 episodes, your conversations about the show, sorry, not conversations, comfortable, and supplementary materials does pique my interest, but the stack of unwatched DVDs next to my TV brings me to realise it's probably going to be a while. When did entertainment get to be homework? It's been like that for a while, I think. I don't even recall buying the new Ghostbusters movie. Alas, it sits atop the pile. Thanks for everything, Matt Prather. Is that the new Ghostbusters movie or the old new Ghostbusters?
I was going to say.
Because I'm confused
new
at this point.
Ghostbusters or the new Ghostbusters?
Yeah. So, yeah, was that not the original Ghostbusters? The real Ghostbusters was the cartoon.
Yes. So now we look like...
But is this the one with Paul Rudd and the kid from Stranger Things?
Yeah.
So it's not the one with all the women and Chris Hemsworth?
No.
Right. Because, I'm thoroughly confused with where Ghostbusters
is. Because haven't they done a Star Wars and brought back the dead actor as a gross CGI ghost?
I see that one. I've seen that one. Yeah, they brought Harold Ramis back as a CGI ghost and I did not approve.
Is it a sequel to that one?
I think there's now a new...
Right.
New Ghostbusters. Right, okay. And the one I've seen is the old new Ghostbusters.
Right.
In that the new old Ghostbusters carried on from the old Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And the women Ghostbusters was an alternate reality.
Yeah.
That some people have said was no good and we were ignoring it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was no good because I've never seen it.
No.
Because Ghostbusters is one of those franchises like Transformers. It's a boat. And I'm on the island just waving as it goes by.
It's where I love those first two Ghostbusters films.
I like the first one.
The more Ghostbusters we get, the less I seem to care about Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a big fan following. It does. Fair play to them. If they're going seeing the movies, then the movies must be doing well.
Yeah.
Which is why they keep churning more of them out.
That's true.
So, you know, I'm pretty sure that the boat is sailing on happily. Powered by money. And it doesn't care.
Nope.
But a party. It's sliders to Slimer. Sorry, not sliders. There's stuff in his face with sausage.
Yeah.
Not that kind.
You know. So I'm on a cruise. What stays on the cruise liner?
No judgment.
Yeah.
But as I'm on the island, guys, they're just going, you don't care about us. Okay.
And you're on your own, so who's the real loser?
Who's the real loser?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's me on the island.
You could be shoving sausages in your mouth.
But I'm actually trying to get the sticks to light a fire.
See, they've got electricity on that boat.
Throw me a light! Anyway, Today we are covering, this was your choice.
It was my choice.
This was a Michael choice. A DC Black Label series, which means, ooh, lovely sex and lovely swearing and lovely violence. Ooh, best kind of comics. Catwoman, Lonely City by Cliff Chiang. Did I say that right? Is it Chiang? Because it's got an I in it.
Yeah.
There ain't no I in team, but there is a me.
There is a pie.
There is. Everyone loves a good pie.
You get a meat version. And if you change meat, you
get right, so slider eating, slimer eating sausages.
In January of 1993, DC Comics launched a brand new imprint with the aim of telling more mature, adult-oriented stories that wouldn't have to adhere to the restrictions of the mainline books, as well as slowly folding in currently running titles that were veering off into that similar direction. Overseen by former literature and art history student Karen Berger, the imprint would have a very long, very successful, and very influential life. The imprint was, of course, Vertigo. The creation of Vertigo wasn't overnight, and had been slowly growing since the publication of books such as Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns, but it isn't the focus of today's show. And besides, I'm sure someone more eloquent than me has probably already covered a deep dive of the beloved imprint. What's more important is to emphasise two things. Firstly, Vertigo was, and still is, incredibly influential even long after its slow and whimpering death. Not only was this due to Berger steering the ship, but the creatives behind some of the imprint's biggest titles set out to make something that was different to any of the books on the other side of DC's proverbial coin. It wasn't about having the ability to make Batman safe. It was about having the freedom to tell a tale that the usual restrictions wouldn't let them, whether it be through deconstructing and reinventing characters such as Swamp Thing or the Sandman, or creating whole new stories like Preacher or 100 Bullets.
So what you're saying there is being able to show his batarang is not a reason to create this imprint, well, rather...
Yeah, well, we'll get there.
And...
Secondly, Vertigo had a distinct identity. It was created by those with literary and artistic backgrounds, was driven with the desire to experiment, but at the same time was deeply rooted into the zeitgeist of the era. Simply put, it was the product of the right people at the right time. Imagine it's 1995. Alice in Chains have dropped their self-titled album. Your mates brought it over so you can both listen to it while you play Mortal Kombat 3. It's school break, so later on you might swipe some of your dad's beer and go skating in the park. And in the back of your mind, you remind yourself that at some point you need to write your English essay on The Tempest. Now, your mileage may vary, but to me that pretty much sums up the general vibe that I've always gotten from Vertigo, which is impressive considering that I was only 3 months old when that album came out. This is to make you all feel a little older out there.
I don't feel old. I'm every day, every way, I'm getting better and better.
Now, sadly, Vertigo was put to pastures in January of 2020 after years of editorial changes and an attempted relaunch. It was immediately replaced, however, with another imprint, DC Black Label.
But can we take a moment to actually discuss why Vertigo was gotten rid of?
Well...
In recent months, Garth Ennis, for whatever reason, has been on the interview trail.
Oh, well, he rarely does that.
Very rarely, until recently.
Right, okay.
When all of a sudden he's popping up on podcasts.
Right.
He's popping up on Mark Miller's YouTube channel.
Yeah.
He's popping up in magazines. And ostensibly, it was to promote Battle Action and James Bond.
Yeah.
Which were the two books that he's had out most recently. And a lot of... traffic was gathered around the fact that Garth Ennis is finally getting to write James Bond,
right.
And he's obviously trying to drum up interest in Battle Action, something that, let's be honest, only a British audience will give a toss about.
Presumably
he's trying to get that in front of American eyeballs or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of people have used the opportunity, as you may imagine,
okay,
to ask Ennis overall questions about his career.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And he's talked a lot about Vertigo. One of the more interesting ones was the interview with Mark Miller.
Right.
Well, because they were both there relatively at the beginning
of
Vertigo.
Yeah, yeah.
Ennis was. Miller came in slightly later.
Yeah.
But they both had similar stories that Karen Berger and Jeanette Kahn and a couple of others, Dick Giordano, I think, made a conscious effort to bring new blood into Vertigo.
Right, okay.
And the deals... were very favourable.
Yeah, which is further, because that's how it started.
So the creator deals were very favourable. They own the rights to everything that they created under the Vertigo imprint. Weirdly, it means Neil Gaiman does not own Sandman, because that predates Vertigo.
Right, okay.
But Mark Miller was saying, like, they were selling 600,000-700,000 copies of these really esoteric, really quite unusual comic books at that time.
Yeah.
And he was saying, so that was putting, like, you know, a lot of money in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Because it was creator-owned stuff. Ennis later talked about how there was somebody wanted something. Brian K. Vaughan, I think it was, wanted something to take Why the Last Man to Vertigo. And do something with Vertigo. And the deal that he was trying to hammer out was for rights and all that stuff. And what he wanted was, Berger was apparently said to him, because it was one of the last things she was involved with, I think.
Yeah.
He said to him, I can't even get Neil Gaiman that deal now.
Right.
So the change was already happening.
Yeah.
What Ennis said that I found very interesting in that interview was that somebody, we think Dan DiDio, but that's just a guess on my part,
right,
has said that Vertigo was a very bad deal.
Okay.
And Ennis is saying it wasn't a very bad deal.
Yeah.
Unless you were a corporate company.
Yeah.
It was a bad deal for them, but it meant the creators kept their own rights.
Because it does seem very telling that around this time, a lot of DC creatives were not necessarily jumping ship, but also doing more and more stuff for Image.
Yep.
We've seen in the last few years, big creatives start up their own companies as well.
Yeah, Frank Miller's recently done it, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And he's took Sin City with him.
Yeah.
And he's doing Ronin 2 as part of this creative initiative with Dan DiDio.
Yeah.
So it seems quite interesting to me that DiDio's now flopped on this.
Right.
But that's what killed Vertigo.
Yeah.
Suddenly, DC did not want to hand over the rights to your creations to the people that created it.
Yeah, yeah.
And as it currently stands, if you want to make a TV show or a film or whatever of that stuff, you've got to get the permission of the creator and include them in the cash.
And they want to avoid that.
I got the impression, subtextually, Ennis was pretty much saying that's why he no longer does much work for DC.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few. I mean, some creatives are more open than others, and occasionally you'll see on scroll.
Well, it's weirdly, it's quite diplomatic.
It's probably because some of his biggest titles were for them, so he's still got to be at least pretend to be nice to them, I guess.
Sublet, I get the feeling he doesn't feel like he owes them that. I just get the feeling he's quite diplomatic because it seems to me that he had a great relationship with Jeanette Kahn, and Karen Berger. Not perhaps a great relationship with Paul Levitz,
right?
Who took one look at the boys having published six issues with DC, and said, we ain't publishing this, And then they took it to Dynamite, and he's since done quite a lot of work for Dynamite,
Well, I think it's a shame as well. This is the fact that once you get to kind of maybe like the mid early 2000s, that kind of period, is it stops becoming.
It's a shadow of its former self.
Yeah. And especially once kind of Berger starts to leave and it starts being taken over and then reshuffled, you've already kind of lost what it is, which is a shame.
Yeah.
I suppose we'll talk about it more when we actually do Vertigo in the future.
Yeah.
So Black Label was launched before Vertigo died and was launched in September of 2018 with the publication of Batman Damned, the eagerly anticipated follow-up to Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo's previous collaborations. Black Label was intended to allow these creatives to tell mature and intentionally edgy stories that may or may not be a part of the current continuity. As demonstrated by Dan DiDio on an episode of DC All Access, the Black Label books would have a larger square-shaped dimensions and be printed as square-bound prestige editions. Unless, of course, that title ran longer than the usual miniseries, in which case it would be a standard-sized comic dimensions. Or it's The Three Jokers, which was in development since before the Black Label, and the artwork produced already fit those dimensions and couldn't be refitted to the Black Label dimensions. May sound like I'm starting to be a little bit petty here, but see, compared to the Earth One books, which stuck to their uniform design, this brand new label was already stepping on its own toes only a handful of years after its debut. It doesn't help that even before its first issue under the Black Label imprint hit the stands, it was already in the girthy shadow of Bruce Wayne's equipment. A single panel from the first issue of Batman Damned showing Bruce's shadowy schlong
to Wang
caused quite a bit of, quote, controversy even being covered by the news and late night shows. Didio and Lee announced that in future reprints, the Nads would be removed. And behind the scenes, this would cause a massive turmoil due to the Time Warner merge with AT&T. But it's hard not to see this as an attempt to drum up the sales and get people talking about the book.
Yeah, and it's also the main difference between Black Label and Vertigo.
Yeah.
There's not really any innovation in Black Label.
No.
It's can we tell slightly more mature stories
yeah.
with already existing characters?
Yeah.
Batman, Catwoman, most of them seem to have been Batman.
Yeah.
There's been a Frank Miller Superman origin story, hasn't there? Which I'm tempted to read.
Okay.
If I can find a copy for dirt cheap, because there ain't no way I'm spending decent wedge on that. Yeah.
I think the thing is, it comes kind of... Vertigo came out in the perfect place at the perfect time. Let's say...
Which Ennis said on that Mark Miller interview.
Let's say post-crisis was this bright, perfect, refined renaissance. Vertigo was the Baroque. It was, you know, big, arty, bold, dynamic, and a bit dirty and misshapen. Whereas now... You know, I know a lot of fingers get pointed towards it, but you're in the era of the MCU and superhero saturation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Batman and the Joker is now what Venom and Wolverine and the Punisher were in the 90s and that kind of vibe. And so these titles now, you know, they're not arty, they're not different, they're not saying anything new. They are, what new situation can we put Batman in?
Mm.
What way can we... You know, it's and it all just seems another way to just tell Batman stories or to just be edgy and trying to be that kind of thing. It's being adult without being mature.
Unless it's this, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But and some of them, Superman Space Age was great.
Is that Black Label?
Yes.
Right.
I believe so, because Batman Dark Age is.
Right.
And they are of a piece.
Yeah.
They're both written by Mark Russell. They're both drawn by the All Reds.
Yeah.
And both Superman Space Age was great.
Right.
Batman Dark Age is brilliant so far. Okay. Very much a different take on Bruce's origin while still having everything in place.
Yeah.
And the one Dan Jurgens just did.
Oh, The First Knight.
Yeah, that's right. Really good.
See, I think it's such a shame because Vertigo is represented by itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's got all these great things under its umbrella, but you know Vertigo. You know what Vertigo is, what Vertigo kind of represents. I think the shame with... Again, let's extend this to Earth One. Earth One had a uniform look. It had a mission statement and it stuck to it.
Mm.
You know, it ultimately failed, arguably because of that mission statement, but it stuck for it. Black Label isn't defined by anything. It's so different. And I feel like that wasn't the intention. You know, why give your titles a different format to then not stick with it?
Mm.
Why create...
Yeah, why is Batman Dark Age just a regular comic set?
And that's the thing. I feel like Vertigo knew what it was. Black Label doesn't.
Given its origin point, that's not really a surprise.
Yeah.
And the fact that some of this stuff is as good as it is...
Yeah.
...is a surprise.
Yeah. But it's, you know, a bit rocky. And understandably, it's not the 90s anymore. You know, these large companies are being bought out by even larger companies. And I appreciate that the boss has another boss above them who's telling them what to do with orders from an even higher boss. You know, I work for the council. I get it. There's a lot of bosses above you telling you what to do. And some of these companies have a much stronger desire for family-friendly content. You know, after... Oppenheimer, we're suddenly in an era where people are demanding, you know, less sex in films and these kind of things. Everything's got to be a bit family friendly now. But after 6 years after its launch, the Black Label seems to be afraid to be the very thing that it set out to replace. You know, there's no defining line that separates the Black Label from the main DC books. Some Black Label books are even continuations of the mainline DC books. Jeff Lemire recently did a Swamp Thing story arc that was a sequel to his Animal Man run. Scott Snyder did a Batman Black Label book that was a sequel to his Batman stuff. So there's no divide in here. Even Vertigo titles are being reprinted under the Black Label banner. And
older, like Ronin is being reprinted as a DC Black Label. That predates Vertigo and this.
What I did find quite funny as I was looking at omnibuses the other day, the white whales that never be able to afford. And I was looking at the Grant Morrison Doom Patrol. Grant Morrison was writing Doom Patrol before Vertigo, but it became Vertigo.
Yeah, for
the Omnibus is a Vertigo Omnibus. The Rachel Pollack Doom Patrol was printed under Vertigo, but her Omnibus is a Black Label one. So I thought that was kind of a funny little way the timeline shifted for them.
That is quite interesting.
And I suppose it doesn't also help us, like we mentioned, the vast majority of these books are mostly centered around one character in particular, Batman. As of July 2023, 2024 even, as of July 2024, there are 55 Black Label titles either published or in development, and 25 of those, nearly half, are Bat Family books. So, you know, with all of these restrictions in place, no defining separation or identity of its own, it seems to me at least to have come full circle. The Black Label just allows creatives to do little more than just making Batman say f***. But anyway, to completely disregard everything that I've just said, today we're covering a Bat Family title that has Batman characters say f***.
Interestingly, not Catwoman.
Did you go through and see if she says it at all?
Right. While I was reading it, I noticed it.
Yeah.
It's like there's only certain characters are allowed to swear.
I wonder if that's a decent thing.
Catwoman just doesn't swear. Maybe she doesn't need to. Yeah. You know.
So Catwoman Lonely City. It's do you want to swap? Well, I've got to do the synopsis.
Yeah, you've got to do the synopsis.
Catwoman Lonely City is a 4-issue miniseries written, illustrated, inked, and coloured by Cliff Chiang, published between Octobers of both 2021 and 2022.
It took a year for this to come out.
Yeah, I was surprised with that, because I don't remember it taking that long, but when I checked, so that's what all sources said.
Right, because I've only ever read your copies of this.
Yeah.
Again, real, not digital.
Not real.
And therefore, I had no idea how long it took to come out. Which is Dan DiDio's argument, isn't it? Or was it Quisada's argument that once it's in trade, nobody cares how late it was.
Yeah, but so. even I suppose, even if it was bi-monthly, I just don't remember it taking that long, but whatever, that's what the numbers say. But I've been a big fan of Chang's since his brief stints on Paul Dini's Satana run back in 2010, and of course he rose more prominent in popularity with the success of Paper Girls, an Image Brian K. Vaughan series that he did, which was adapted into a TV show. So I was very interested in a mini that had this, he had complete control over, and it showed this more mature deconstruction of characters who struggle to let go of the past. It's kind of a meet in the middle between Selena's Big Score and Star Trek II and The Last Jedi. So as well as everything else, Chang also illustrated all the covers, with guests taking up variant cover duties. The first one is great. I think this is used in a lot of the
It's a lot of the promo stuff.
It's old Selena in her workout gear, jumping across the skyline, and in her expanded silhouette, it's all the more iconic different versions of her costume.
Yeah, the Ed Brubaker versions, the Jim Ballant version, which they make a nice little gag about. Julie Newmar, interestingly, is given front and centre.
Yeah.
But also there's Michelle Pfeiffer, and weirdly, that's the Halle Berry mask.
It is, yeah.
So Halle Berry's on the cover, and then obviously the 1940s version and so on and so forth.
The animated ones on the...
Yeah, the animated ones. Yeah, both from both with different versions. Book 2 was the only cover I thought was a little bit bland.
Mm.
It's just Catwoman avoiding being shot at as she jumps over a bunch of cars.
Yeah.
It's not terribly interesting. The third one's more interesting. She's hiding behind a statue on the grounds of Wayne Manor, I presume, being hunted by the Batmen, which are the secret police essentially of the era. And then issue 4 has her actually get into the Batcave, and you know that because the giant penny and the dinosaur are there.
Do you like that the rocks are in a perfect bat shape? We're seeing them at the right angle.
Yeah. Well, Batman's all about his brand.
He is. Right, so let's get into it. On the night that will be remembered as Fool's Night, the Batman dies. In his final breaths, he tells Catwoman to take him back to the Batcave. Take him to Orpheus. But Catwoman is arrested, believed to have killed Batman, and to be responsible for the deaths of the police who rushed to the scene of the Batman and the Joker's final battle, but are caught in a trap laid by the Clown Prince of Crime. In the years that follow, a reformed Harvey Dent is elected in as mayor of Gotham City. Under his rule, he and the fascistic Bat Police keep the city crime and vigilante free, using the database on the Bat computer to keep tabs on every single citizen in the city. With re-election looming, Dent is planning on constructing a new football stadium after demolishing the impoverished areas around Crime Alley, which is causing uproar with the residents who are represented by former Batgirl Barbara Gordon. To sway the election his way, Dent has an ace up his sleeve. After 10 long years, Selina Kyle has an early release from prison and finds herself in a city she no longer recognises and doesn't want her back. The Penguin makes it clear that organised crime has changed now due to tighter laws in Gotham and that working with her after her jail time isn't a safe bet anymore. She's not the young cat burglar she once was. Barbara also wants little to do with her, still resenting her for the events of 10 years ago. Selina feels an urge to prove herself once more. A desperately needed stop in an old watering hole leads to a chance encounter with Killer Croc, the self-proclaimed former King of Gotham, who now lingers on his old glory days. Dent also decides to drop by. He tells Selina that her current stubbornness and refusal to change will only end with her back in jail. Her only other choice is to end up like Croc, spending his days drunk and clinging on to the past. But all Dent does is make Selina need to prove herself even more. She tells Croc that there's one last score left for them to case the Batcave and sell the loot. Selina's true motives are hidden, however, as what she really wants is to find the truth behind Bruce's dying words, to find the truth behind what Orpheus is. Little does Selina know that it was Dent who released her from prison, knowing that she wouldn't be able to change her ways, and believing that the permanent arrest or execution of the woman who killed Batman would cement his re-election. Aided by Rowena Yao and her son, Winston, Selina and Croc spend the following weeks training themselves back into shape, and end up picking up Edward Nygma and his daughter Edie along the way. Selina finds comfort in Nygma, and even reluctantly becomes a mentor to Edie. Things are looking good, especially when Pamela Isley also joins the team, but the constant run-ins with Dent and the Bat Police only causes more tension between the mayor and the people of Gotham, as well as bringing out Dent's long-repressed second face. Just as things are looking up, though, everything comes crashing down. With just a week left until re-election and Selina's raid on the Batcave, Croc is gunned down while escaping from a job to steal the helmet of Naboo. The helm is used to convince Jason Blood to help them disarm the Batcave's magical security, but the death of Croc is all Selina needs to break the gang apart. The mission needs to go ahead sooner than planned, and to keep unnecessary risk down, Selina only brings with her Winston, Ivy, and Blood. The gang begin the infiltration of Wayne Manor, but the patrolling Bat Police catch wind and swarm in, causing Blood to forego the form of man and become the demon, Etrigan. Pushing further into the cave, the team finally learn the truth behind Orpheus. Bruce had his own Lazarus Pit, but unlike the Lazarus, the second life given by the Orpheus Pit was only a short one. Selina now realises that all Bruce ever wanted was just more time, however short, to continue his fight for Gotham. Dent and the Bat Police swarm the cave to place the gang under arrest. Clarion the Witch Boy forces Etrigan into another dimension, and Ivy sacrifices herself, pulling the cave down onto the officers. As the cave comes down around her, Selina finally puts the past behind her, and in the moment she accepts her fate, the Nygmas show up to rescue her just in time. In the aftermath, Dent is placed under arrest after evidence of his corruption is leaked, and Barbara Gordon wins the election in a landslide, a major win for the people of Gotham. Selina now accepts her place as mentor, with Edie taking her place as Catwoman, and Barbara knows that the road ahead might be tough, with corruption still hiding in the city. Barbara's fight can only be fought in the light, but Selina's work at night can help bring that corruption to light. She's reluctant, but allows herself to let go of the past and embrace her place in Gotham's future.
Oh, right. Very good. Very good synopsis.
Synopsis are harder than you think.
They are, which is why I now only do like four lines.
It's harder to say. I mean, I talk all the time, but, you know, suddenly...
It's different reading it.
You get a tickle at the back of your throat.
I did synopsis on this show for God knows how long. Yeah. And every now and again, you do it. And it was always a blessing when you did it. But that's why our synopsis are now painfully slow.
I'll remember that.
Slow's very short. Yeah. I don't do full synopsis anymore.
Okay.
Go. We'll spoil it in the conversation, for which I do apologise. But if people are going to read it, you don't want to tell them every detail of the thing. I mean, it's not like we get kickbacks, DC, Marvel, every other book we've ever covered. The Black Label books are currently actually what I think DC should be doing more of. They're larger than usual. They're like magazine size, like the Savage Sword of Conan magazine. They're largely out of continuity stories with more adult situations and dialogue. And they're a far more mature way of exploring the characters than, you know, just being titillation.
Yeah.
I like that this is a post-Batman world. And as we'll get into as we discuss this, this is very much Catwoman's Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
But it's very definitely in the same continuity as Batman Year One. Right down to some of the dialogue.
Right, okay.
Which I'll point out as we go along. But the other interesting thing as well, like, the Batman one that Juergens has just done, First Night, is very clearly set in, like, the early 1900s.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just like the old Elseworlds.
Right.
But what Batman just seems to work better in that post-Prohibition time period.
Right.
Where there's no cameras. So you can actually buy him as being urban myth.
Yeah, you can, no phones, no CCTV, anything like that.
Yeah. So Exhibit A, my lord, compare the cover of this pulp magazine, which we talked about earlier on, to the covers DC are turning out on their regular books. So for the purposes of this,
right,
I pulled up DC's covers for the month this came out.
Right.
On Mike's Amazing Worlds. Rest in peace, Mike. Your site is still magnificent. December 2021. Mm-hmm. You said this came out, didn't you? And was greeted by mostly muddy-coloured, vaguely AI-looking generic images. Often homages to other comics.
Right.
Compare that to what Cliff Chiang has delivered here. A lovely pull image of Catwoman through the years, as we mentioned, prime of place given to Julie Newmar, the animated versions, the more modern versions of Selina Kyle, leaping through the air. As you point out, the silhouette of her is wherein all those images are in place, which is just a gorgeous piece of pulp comic book art.
Yep.
But what have they done to Selina and her Cat O' Nine Tails to make it, like, shiny?
It's not quite embossed, but kind of,
yeah,
isn't it?
And they do it on each cover.
Yeah.
Each cover has an embossed, for want of a better term, or a shinier. I don't know what the technical term for that is.
Because it's a different feeling if you kind of rub your finger across it.
Yeah, you can feel that it's slightly raised, slightly shiny. It's really well done. The line work is exceptionally strong, simple but not simplistic. Bringing to my mind Darwin Cook, Jimmy Hernandez, like Parabek, that kind of thing. And a little splash of colour, rather than the muted oranges, I think would have been appreciated.
Mm.
Rather than just being orange and black.
See, I don't know. I think that helps it kind of stand. Yeah. That just that contrast and that use of the use of colour, yeah.
Yeah, all right, okay. I mean, it doesn't spoil it. It's a lot better than was what wrapped around the rest of the line.
Because I also think as well, with it just being just shades of orange, it helps bring out, because there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of characters crammed into this tight space. I think colour would have made it look a bit too busy, whereas here this it's clean.
Mm.
And I feel like that sums up the art style in general. It's clean, it's tight.
Yep, don't disagree. It's comic book cartoony, but in a good way.
Mm.
And it doesn't seem at odds with the story either, which is a neat trick for them to pull off. Selina's 55 here, the same age Bruce was in Dark Knight Returns.
Okay.
Or The Dark Knight.
Right.
I know there are some people out there like, was it called Dark Knight Returns in the comic? And they're right. Okay. You know, they get a pedantry award, but they are correct.
Yeah.
So it was only The Dark Knight in the comics. Stylistically, as I mentioned, it's more akin to Year One in that it relies very much on that Frank Miller trope of using news and TV interviews to propel the narrative.
Yeah, and as well, I feel like because we're coming into this world like Selina, she knows nothing about it. We know the dialogue and the news reports do a really good job of just bringing you up to speed on the world.
Yep. Yeah, the world in which this takes place. Where are all the other superheroes?
Yeah.
What's happened to everybody else?
Yeah.
And he gives you all that as you go along. Like you said earlier on, if you watch it or read it, the plot will be explained to you. And that's the case with this. Not everything's explained in issue one.
No.
Which I appreciated. I don't need an info dump at the beginning.
Yeah.
Take your time. Explain what needs to be explained as you go along through the
and
story.
It's kind of nice as well, you're learning things with Selina, so kind of halfway through this character will show up and Selina's like, oh, I forgot about you, and as the reader you're like, oh, I forgot about you. Like, we're seeing things develop as she does.
Yes, it's masterfully done. I thought this we're not spoiling it by saying I think this is a lovely companion piece to Year One.
Mm.
Oh, but not Dark Knight Returns, because obviously it's a different ending for Batman.
Yeah.
And Catwoman lends herself to the pulps, arguably more than Batman does.
Yeah.
Because you've got that inherently pulpy setup, cat burglar with a noble heart.
Yeah, and I think it's the thing as well, simply through Batman's vigilanteism, he's above the grime, whereas Selina is in the grime.
And also him having money.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of puts him in that place as well. But as a reader, a viewer, whatever, we always love a bad guy with a moral heart. Almost as much as we love a good guy vigilante.
Yeah.
Because it's that clash of tone. Well, how can you be a good guy vigilante?
Yeah.
How can you be a bad guy but be noble?
Oh, the good bad guy is always the most interesting dynamic for a
character. Yeah, two pretty good bad men. Elliot Smith and Jones. Both are moral quandaries and inherently contradictory. But that's, I think, what appeals to us.
Yeah.
Because nobody is good or evil.
Yeah.
Even, you know, some of the most heinous figures in history probably had likable character traits.
Yeah. It's like the flip side of that is you get a lot of people saying, say, Superman, for example, not relevant. Well, no, he is supposed to be good. He is supposed to be pure. He is supposed to be this embodiment of everything that is good. Mm. And to say otherwise is a misunderstanding of that. And that works because that's who he is, but... And you can do interesting things with that. Well, how do you keep being pure and good in a world that isn't pure and good?
Yeah.
And it's the same with other things. Well, how do you stay good when you are bad, when you are a criminal? How, you know?
Yeah. And when society won't let you be anything but that.
Yeah.
Because it's mentioned frequently in this that she's free now. She's out of jail. She served her time.
Yeah.
But they frequently won't let her forget her past.
And it's... Not only is it an interesting character dynamic, but it's also integral to the plot, is that she goes out of her way to be bad to prove a point because she's stubborn. She can't change. She wants to change, but she can't. And the more she's told that she needs to change, she doesn't want to change.
The more she
just because she's
back.
Stubborn. Yeah.
Well, she's a cat.
Yeah.
So, you know, Two-Face is Gotham, like a lot of gentrification in major cities. Relies on an almost brutal police force, all dressed with Batman symbols, and its mutation into a surveillance state is interesting because it's something that people live with if they think it makes them safer.
Yeah.
And we've seen that all over the world, particularly here, where it wasn't London once called the most CCTV'd major metropolis in Europe.
Yeah.
So... You know,
and it's also when it came out as well, not really that anything has changed. They attack civilians, wrongly so, which is, again, something that still happens predominantly. This isn't a dystopian future. This is our dystopian reality.
Mm. There's a lot of Judge Dredd to the Bat Police.
Yeah.
Which is probably what, you know, part of the influence of it. The loss of cash. I thought it was an interesting topic, shown to be something that controls the populace.
Mm.
We've seen that more and more.
Yeah.
Because they can monitor your credit ratings much easier if you're ever only using a piece of plastic.
Yeah.
You yourself found that they were able to look exactly what you were spending your money on when you were looking for a mortgage.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were kind of suggesting that maybe you shouldn't eat dinner.
Yeah. Oh, you go to Tesco a lot. Oh, sorry.
Sorry that I have to eat to live. I do apologize. So, you know, there's a lot of little... And he doesn't comment on that good or bad either way.
It's played off kind of for laughs where she goes to a coffee shop and it's about $10 and you have to pay on cash. And then she goes to a bodega down the road and it's only $2 and she can pay with change.
And it's a much better coffee.
Yeah.
Was a nice tip.
It's kind of... It's a bit higher. And I think we see that an awful lot now. Like, oh, you millennials and your expensive coffee and it's all contactless. But it works. It does what it does.
I love the bit where she feels it in her knees.
Yeah.
There's a lovely $6 million man just got a rerun on Legend and I'd catch the odd episode here and there. And when he does his jump in, as a kid, you're like, oh, that's cool. As an adult, I'm going, I bet that killed his knee.
Well, it's constant about how she's battling her age. When we saw Wrath of Khan the other week, one of its strengths is that it allows its characters to age. And this does that. These aren't even more so with this when you've got perfect, bright coloured heroes and villains.
Yeah.
Here, this is them real.
Yeah.
And, you know, they age. They can't run around and jump about anymore.
Yeah.
So what happens when they have to do the same superhero antics, but with bad knees and backs?
Yeah. And throughout this, I was just thinking Charlize Theron would be perfect.
Yeah.
As Catwoman in this. Because she must be in her 50s now, Charlize Theron, right?
I wouldn't know.
She must be roughly of that age. Of all the rogues to make a go of it, I'd buy the Penguin as the one who made hay whilst the sun shined. His money laundering business, undercover of his nightclubs, which he's now got like a fleet, is almost a legit way of doing what he's always done.
And it's cute as well. He mentions that he has to do it offshore so he can avoid Gotham's laws.
Yep. So I bought that. And I quite like seeing that the Penguin had mostly gone straight. Mostly. That's very Aliens, wasn't it?
Mostly.
The Joker's broadcast has him now be the clown king of comedy rather than a prince. The Joker's movie, perhaps?
Maybe.
Which was essentially a remake of King of Comedy?
Yeah.
So he's not the clown prince of comedy anymore, he's the crown king of comedy. And I've really liked how they developed the relationship between Croc and Selina.
Oh, Croc's great in this.
Yes,
yeah.
Croc's absolutely brilliant in this. I love them getting him back into shape and doing his exercising, which I think is in issue two. I've not actually made what's his name notes by issue. I've just read it as one whole thing when I was doing it.
It's really kind of interesting world building as well that I really like is there's a lot of cameos and references and Easter eggs in the form of branding. So superheroes have now become brands.
Yeah.
And again, it's another cute way of showing in Easter eggs, but also superheroes are brands. We wear Batman t-shirts and Superman t-shirts.
Yeah, and there's a guy in this who's constantly wearing superhero paraphernalia. Yeah. We'll point that out as
and
we go along.
Cute deep cuts. I mean, Wildcat shows up and then Ma Hunkel's in it as well. It's
the Warner Brothers shop, which has two people later on telling Selina they had posters of her on the wall.
Yeah.
And the young man had the Jim Fallon poster. Yeah. And the young girl had the Darwin Cook version.
Yeah.
And I let Catwoman appeal to different people for different reasons. I thought that was quite cool. As somebody now 50 plus, I liked all the stuff about them attempting to get back in shape at 50 plus.
Yeah.
I am now in my fourth week of running 2 miles every day.
Right. Very good.
So I'm giving it a go. I like this goes into what we were discussing earlier on, the subtlety of the implication that total security may be safe, but it isn't necessarily good for the general populace. The relationship, did you see the Riddler picture?
Yeah.
On page 14 of issue 2, that's the Jim Curry Riddler. Curry,
yeah.
That's literally a freeze frame from... No, it's not. It's one of the pre-publicity photos, isn't it?
Yes, it
from
is,
Batman
yeah.
Forever, yeah.
But there's really nice characterization. There is a bit in here, though, and I do think there's this underlying caveat that I do have with this series as a whole. It's an incredibly optimistic story in an otherwise cynical world, but there's still elements of that cynicism that bleed through from time to time. So, for example, as I've mentioned before, I hate Batman is Bruce Wayne rather than Bruce Wayne is Batman.
Mm.
And here, this story only works if you buy into the fact that he is Batman all the time. Because there's even a line that says, well, you know, if Bruce had just put all of his money to good use rather than fighting crime, he could have helped the city more so. And it's little things like that. And then I think Eddie has a line where he's just like, oh, we were on so much cocaine back in the day, which is the Morrison trope that I don't like as well.
He says he's 12 years clean and sober.
No, there's literally it's during this conversation, I think.
Right, okay. Because this conversation between Selina and
really nice
Eddie
and really
was really
well
good,
written.
Yeah.
But there's just those little things where you just kind of, for this story to work as well as it does, you have got to accept those little niggles.
Yeah, because I hate that. Batman does no social outreach programs when you're like, yes, he does.
Yeah.
He does tons of them.
But you've got to accept that this story doesn't work if that wasn't the case. So it's like fine.
Okay. It's an Elseworlds. I can cope with it. I also like that he goes out of his way in this to say that the Riddler was not a murderer. For him, it was all about just outwitting Batman.
Yeah.
He called himself the world's greatest detective. I had to take a shot at him.
Yeah.
Many shots, says Selina, but I never hurt anybody.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that the Riddler was never a killer.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't like that story. I think Pete Milligan did.
Right.
Where he turned the Riddler into a murderer. I didn't buy that.
And this is a really nice thing as well. this and a lot of the Killer Croc stuff kind of perfectly shows the writing as well. You know, Chang's artwork is great, but I think his writing is also really well done here as well. These are characters with actual relationships.
Yeah.
You know, these aren't, this isn't Catwoman and the Riddler. This is Selina and Eddie having an adult conversation who haven't seen each other for years. You know, they're catching up. They're old friends. And it's just perfectly summed up in just these two pages.
And I like the little snippets of conversations that we get. You and him?
Yeah.
How could you not know? Everybody made jokes. Who were they on about, though?
I don't know.
Were they on about Batman?
Don't know.
I don't know either. But, the little snippets of conversations and him giving him his phone number. And then I love that the flashbacks, we mentioned this earlier on, that the flashbacks dole out the information without being info dumps.
Mm.
And it's difficult, that. Because flashbacks have become such a trope of modern storytelling that The Acolyte did it recently, where they literally did a reasonably decent two-part opening pilot episode, basically, and killed story momentum dead by having a flashback episode.
Right.
And then they repeated that at the end of the series.
Okay.
Flashback episode before the finale.
Right.
And you're like, oh, great. I love that the art in this sequence is... It's Julie Newmar and Adam West.
Yeah. Well, I do love as well that it doesn't care about continuity timeline. Right. It's just these things happen, so we know that this is a flashback because these are the old costumes for us. And it's just a really nice way of, it's again, it's an Easter egg, it's a reference, but it's also used to tell the story.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to say this is a flashback. You just automatically know because of these costumes.
Mm-hmm. Right, so we have to go and steal the Green Lantern ring, which is the heist, and now it becomes Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. It's really well written and drawn. And it works because we've got a history with the characters.
Mm.
And this is where comics really come into their own more than other storytelling mediums. Because you have got a long history and backstory with these characters. Not necessarily a continuity, because this doesn't follow any single continuity.
No.
There's year one in here, Adam West's in here, other stuff's in here. But because you've got that backstory, that history with the characters, because of the long narrative of comics, it really works. Because even though it doesn't necessarily fit into a specific continuity you may have in your head, it fits into the overall continuity of the characters, be that what it may. So you can have this be, you know, post-crisis, pre-crisis, whatever you want it to be. And the characters work because you've got that knowledge of, everyone knows who Catwoman is.
Yeah.
Everyone knows who Batman is. Even if they've not read comics, they've seen The Dark Knight Rises. They've seen Catwoman in the TV show. They've seen Batman Returns.
Yeah.
So the fact that there are different versions of Catwoman plays into the whole thing. And that's what gives it its heft.
And it's there as well, you know, in the flashback, we've got a different version of them, but it's still the same people.
Yeah.
The posters are different versions, but it's still the same person.
Yeah. And I love that Two-Face is very much the Tommy Lee Jones Two-Face, isn't he? He's slightly cracking up with every bit, even though he's subsumed the Harvey Dent personality.
Yeah.
And Two-Face is kind of taking over more and more as we go along through the story.
Yeah.
Which and I thought was well done.
Again, kind of a parallel to Catwoman's. You know, the more you change, the more you stay the same. The more you try to stay the same, the more you change. And
I liked that the Star Labs patrolmen used the Rocket Red armor.
Yes, yeah.
Which was originally a Russian superhero.
It was, yeah.
So have they bought this tech from the Russians?
Maybe.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Two-Face also being a conniving politician works exceptionally well.
Yeah. And a lot of that, I think the politics really works as well with this. This is an overly political story without being about politics.
Yeah. Kind
of when it came out as well, you know, the COVID era was a turbulent time and this perfectly sums it up.
And, well, how subtle can you really be when you've got Two-Face as a politician?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of big neon sign.
Two-Face is here. He's a convicted felon who has found his way into politics.
So, you know. Again, the superhero merchandise is brilliant. We've got a Wonder Woman hoodie.
Yeah.
And worn by Josie Mack.
Right.
You remember Josie Mack?
No.
Backup strip in Detective Comics.
Okay.
Which I thought was quite interesting. Casual reference to Green Lantern's charger being destroyed in some crisis event.
Yep.
So is that what they're called now? Just crisis event?
They just happen. I love that they go through all of this effort to take the Green Lantern ring and then it just breaks.
Yeah. It doesn't do them any good.
And I like the kind of the way that this story's told is that we're just kind of, we just assume that they're doing heists here and there to get the money. It doesn't show you all of them. It tells you about them. But yeah, just, hey, we're doing a little heist here. Oh, that didn't matter. Anyway, we've still got this, you know, main plot going on.
Ace Chemicals is drawn to look like it originally did, I think, or it's in the Batman movie or something. Right. It looks familiar to me, but I didn't source exactly where it was from. It's not that Crocs were in an Ocean Master tracksuit, which is all fantastic.
And then we get to the end and it turns out that Poison Ivy is some kind of... She's a coffee-selling terrorist, isn't she?
Yes.
So she's a freedom fighter using her legitimate coffee business to fund them, which is great.
Do you think this version of Poison Ivy was Gail Simone?
Maybe.
Because her personality is very bubbly and friendly as well. And we've met Gail Simone at a couple of conventions, and she's always very nice. Leslie Tompkins being in it was fun. I don't remember quite where that was now. But it's nice seeing what all the Bat family were up to post the Bat family's existence.
Yeah.
So they don't actually exist anymore. And it's was it coincidence that all the men have been taken off the table?
Probably not. It's probably the intention because it's not about them.
No. It's not. So he's got rid of Bruce, Dick, Tim, Jim Gordon, Alfred.
Yeah.
So there's only the women left to pick up the ball and run with it. Oh, God, this bit was brilliant. So they've got to get a piece of Clayface.
Yeah, so they can change their face to look like one of the politicians. Yep.
So they can do something. What's it? So Clayface is an actor. This entire gag only works if you know that Clayface is a hammy actor.
Yeah.
Like Jonathan Harris from Lost in Space.
Which, again, I feel like is something that's kind of forgotten a bit now that he was an actor.
That he was, but when he eats it, oh, the pen! And you can, I saw that line and I instantly thought of Dr. Smith.
Yeah.
And that level of ham going on, which I thought was quite fun.
There's a lot of things in this that work because Chiang knows his characters so well.
One of the most subtle and amusing nods was that the name of the tree surgeons was Mr. Tree. In the same typeface and font of the old Ms. Tree comics.
Right, okay,
that
cool.
DC published in the 80s and 90s. Yeah. I thought that was absolutely fantastic.
Did love the really annoyed Arkham security guard going, well, this tree wasn't here before. And Eddie's just like, well, it is now.
And it's a really fun heist that suddenly turns tragic when Croc dies.
Yeah.
Was that surprisingly emotional?
Yeah, and it's a testament to how good of a writer he is and how good these characters are, and that we built up this good relationship with the last three issues just to have it pulled away. And just the bit where he does not want to be captured and arrested, so he asks Selina to shoot him.
Yeah.
It's just so well done.
Yeah, and she just leaves the gun there and him in a pool of blood, and then suddenly you're going into Act 3 here. Because I do remember comic creators once said the problem with four-part stories is how do you structure your three acts?
Yeah.
Much better to have a six-part series where you can do your acts in two issues.
Yeah.
So essentially we're going into Act 3 in the midway point of Book 3.
And it works to an extent because we've been having a lot of fun with this so far. We've been doing these little heists. We've been playing these little silly games. And then this is a turning point, you know, it's when things go bad, and things went bad 10 years ago and Selina doesn't want this to happen. And it's a great way because it completely changes the tone of the story now.
Yeah.
We're not having fun anymore. Suddenly this matters and these dynamics change drastically, again, leading into the issue 4.
Yeah, because we've had a death now. Harvey's march into taking Gotham is very It doesn't take a lot to tilt over into a totalitarian state.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's what Cliff Chiang's commenting on.
Yeah.
With the regard that he's upping up the presence of the Bat Police.
We've got big tanks, which we've seen before.
Yeah, he's introducing curfews.
Yeah.
He's doing all the things that curtails your rights.
Yeah.
As a populace. But doesn't see that he's doing that.
He's very much... Because he just wants to make this place good. And even though he has the selfish intentions of he wants to be voted in again, he wants to do what's best for the city that he's the mayor of. What he's learning here, though, is something that we all learn. You grip too tight and it slips away or it breaks. And that's what's happening here on a grand political scale.
Yep. I loved the bit where it doesn't wallow in nostalgia, but like I mentioned, it's looking at the broad tapestry of Batman's publishing history and plucking bits from here and there.
Yeah,
I loved Riddler and Ivy doing the holy history book.
Yeah.
And then Ivy, you'll soon find my blossoms are as deadly as they are beautiful. And Catwoman says, knock it off.
Yeah, because we're not doing that anymore. We're not having fun anymore.
But 2 pages later,
yeah,
Catwoman tells Ivy, you were perfect.
Yeah.
And she's like so delighted that Selina's in on this.
Yeah.
That it just, that's just a lovely panel.
Yeah.
Of Poison Ivy just going, yeah. It was fun, but then Barbara Gordon stands up to the tanks that Harvey's got patrolling the city. Tiananmen Square, anybody?
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know.
Though a part of me did just kind of get flashbacks to that one clip of Michael Jackson, like the assault rifle being pointed at him, and he walks up and he grabs the assault rifle and points it towards his chest. It's very on the nose.
He was a bit pretentious, Michael Jackson, wasn't he? I mean, this is out of sequence for the real events. Harvey doesn't order you to fire on civilians till later.
Yeah.
But he does do it, so, you know.
I love the line, gentlemen, we have eaten well.
Farming year one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Selina's disguise here is Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Isn't it? From with the blonde hair.
Yeah.
The blonde curly hair and the glasses. I think I've gone past comic. But it's Michelle Pfeiffer from Batman Returns, which again is just pulling from the overall tapestry of it, not a specific continuity, which is great. And then the twist here is Selina thinks somebody is feeding them information from the inside. And if you're working with somebody who always likes to feed clues to Batman or the police or whatever,
yeah,
because he likes to outwit them as much as he likes to win,
yeah,
who do you think is going to be the person doing that feeding?
Yeah.
But she's wrong.
Yes.
It isn't. Yeah. It isn't Eddie. He's not doing that at all. So...
And then we get the bit at the end where the plan just falls apart completely at the last minute.
Yeah, leaving them in a bit of a quandary as we go into the final part. I have to confess, I'm always a little bit baffled by the fascination with the demon.
Yeah.
Although I did appreciate you rhymed a little bit in your synopsis.
Yeah.
I thought that was well.
Well, I did like as well, he doesn't rhyme, but he does give a reason as to why he doesn't rhyme as well.
He doesn't do it in this story. Yeah, even the Garth Ennis run couldn't make me
care about the demon. It's one of those interesting choices, because I wouldn't have put the demon in.
Mm.
You would have got... But I mean, Satana is in it, but...
Yeah.
Etrigan is an interesting choice for you breaking into the Batcave.
Yes.
It's one of those...
It didn't ruin it.
No, I mean, I do think that this last issue is the weakest of the lot, and, you know, I'm not saying...
Endings are hard, man.
I'm not saying the demon's... the reason for that, but, you know, it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
An interesting choice.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe I should find, like, a list of essential demon stories.
There is any, I don't know.
There probably is some, but he's a character that's got, like, a cult following. It's not
gonna... I mean, maybe.
So, you know. Some of this last issue is really sad as well, though.
Yeah.
Which works.
Most of it's just them breaking through, but then you'd get, just a few moments here and there.
Yeah, like, Bruce used the Orpheus pit to cure Alfred of cancer.
Yeah.
Knowing that it was only a short reprieve, because, as you mentioned, the Orpheus pit doesn't work quite like the Lazarus pit. And Bruce wanting Selina to take him to the pit seems a bit of an odd choice.
Yeah.
But it would give him a little bit longer.
Yeah. They don't buy the all Bruce/Batman cares about is being Batman, but you have to accept that characterization of him for this story to work.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Alfred stuff's really great. And this
the Alfred stuff's really sweet.
Turn him into this character who is aging and dying of a real natural cause is much better well done than Alfred still being done 5 years later from Tom King having Bane snap his neck.
Is Alfred back yet?
I know, I think he's still dead, isn't it?
Is he still dead?
I don't know.
I can't remember at this point.
Which is a shame, because Alfred is...
Alfred's integral.
Alfred grounds Bruce and Batman.
Alfred's integral to the strip, and if you're going to allow a writer to kill a character like that on your way out of the door,
yeah,
then you have to have a bloody good reason for doing it and have a good thing to replace it.
Yeah.
And as far as, I mean, I quit Chip Zdarsky's run
right
of Batman, largely because I found it incomprehensible. And initially I was like, maybe it's just me, but I did find some threads on various social media guys were going, is it just me or is Batman incomprehensible?
Right.
So it isn't just me. And it'll probably make full sense when Zdarsky's run's finished.
Okay.
But he's not been oofed off the book for the new initiative that's coming out soon.
Oh, has he not? Because no, I know Snyder's...
Snyder's doing the Absolute Batman.
Oh, are they two different things now?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, you'll see when you read the solicitations. The Absolute Batman, Absolute Wonder Woman, Absolute Superman, I've got no interest in. I hope the people that buy them enjoy them.
It's good that they're separate at least then.
Yes. But the regular books have been given a makeover.
Right.
Tom Taylor is moving over to Detective Comics.
Yes.
He's finishing Nightwing.
Okay.
He's going over to Detective Comics with Mikkel Janine.
Yeah, because we've known Nightwing was ending for a while now, haven't we?
Well, it's not that he's getting a new writer.
Yeah.
For a player to him for not relaunching with a new number one.
Yeah.
And Joshua Williamson's carry on writing Superman, but he's got, I can't remember the artist is going with him. So there's like mini relaunches going on.
Okay.
But reading the descriptions of the Absolute stuff, there is a point where you're reading, well, okay, how much can you strip away from the characters before they're not that character anymore?
Yeah.
And why is this not just a Black Label story then?
Yeah.
Why have we got another new publishing initiative? I don't get it. But,
no, time will tell.
I'm on board for Mark Waid and Chris Samnee's Batman and Robin series.
Yeah.
That sounds like great fun. So I'll be there for that. Anyway, Selina has no idea what Orpheus means.
No, and throughout it, this has been her that's driving her, and we've not known what it is.
But my point is, so what did Bruce expect? He'd never told her what Orpheus means.
No.
So he'd not planted the seeds for if something happens to me, take me to the Orpheus pit.
I suppose, because he's saying take me to the cave as well, so I'm guessing, you know, once he's there, he'll know where he's going.
He would know what he was doing. Yeah, I guess.
It's Eddie sums it up best as well. He doesn't exactly explain the Orpheus, but, you know, the story of Orpheus is you look back and you lose what it is that you went into hell for.
Yeah.
And so she stops looking back when she realizes, all she's done is look back.
Mm.
And so she realizes the true meaning behind Orpheus and looks forward now.
And again, Alfred has the line, it's been a good life.
Yeah.
Dark Knight.
Yeah.
This would be a good life.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know. So he's pulling from pretty much everywhere.
And it's also what's quite interesting, I've just noticed as well, Alfred says it's been a good life and he stops. He allows himself, whereas that wasn't what Bruce wanted to do.
Yeah.
He wanted to continue.
He wants to carry on. Quarry and the Witch Boy. Boom, boom, boom.
Just shows up with Teakle, the cat.
Yeah. I quite like his cat.
Felt a bit out of nowhere, but I suppose you need to take the mystical, powerful demon off the board somehow.
And it's the DC Universe, so, you know, those things are in place anyway. I actually thought it was a shame Harvey went full villain at the end. Because I thought he was much more effective as a conflicted, misguided do-gooder.
How do you wrap that up, though?
Yeah, but at the end of the day, it's a comic book about comic book heroes and villains.
Yes.
The complaint everyone has about the MCU at the minute, ultimately, doesn't matter how good the first two-thirds are.
You've got to wrap it up somehow.
Your final third's always going to be two CG creatures beating each other.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shame. But I did like that they still managed to keep the emotion of it, like what happens to Poison Ivy.
Yep.
Is deeply sad.
I like that Selena's just decided she's done now, she's lived her life, and it's Eddie who she pushed away that comes back to save her.
Yeah, and the destruction of the cave, so the destruction of the Orpheus pit, by definition. But the ending is ultimately hopeful.
Yeah, because
Barbara Gordon wins the election.
Yes, yeah. And there's a lot of endings in this, and I think that's why it's so hopeful as well, because we've allowed all this to be put behind us.
Yes.
And now we've got this bright future ahead of us.
Yes. And there's a tree, though, because of course there is.
Because Poison Ivy's grown.
Yeah.
She's re-sprouted.
Yeah, and I like the colourful shot at the end.
I like it. And I think as well, a lot of this kind of resonated because I think both of us have lived in or around, say, Manchester for so long as well. Mm. And every time we go back, there's new massive towers. And it does feel very much like you start then feeling out of place in this place that is so familiar to you now, because it is evolving.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And the ending, that's year one again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bruce and Commissioner Gordon on the roof.
Yeah.
Here, Selina and Mer Gordon on the roof. The fact that she's wearing glasses and has a haircut short.
And has got the trench coat
on. So she looks even more like her dad. That was... this was an excellent series. Covers similar ground to Batman Year One, The Dark Knight. But it's never derivative of those works. It's a testament to what's already known, that not only does Batman have the best rogues gallery in comics, but any one of those rogues is strong enough to hold the interest of the reader in their own series.
Yeah.
Catwoman is probably the best of the best in this regard, because she's walked that line for some years now between enlightened self-interest and Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And that makes her more relatable than some of the others. She's not a good guy.
No.
But she's not a bad guy. And she's not insane, but she's not obsessive. The thieving was mostly for the thrill, the challenge, the adrenaline rush, as well as for the wealth.
Yeah.
Which kind of works well with her relationship with the Riddler in it, because for him it was about the same things.
Yeah.
It wasn't really about getting away with it. It was about the thrill. But the difference is, if Catwoman sees an injustice, she tackled it.
Mm.
So she was never 100% good guy or bad guy or whatever. Batman sees that duality in her, because that's in himself.
Mm.
And that's what he's attracted to, and that's what she's attracted to.
Yeah.
The other characters are already very well fleshed out, well-meaning men who can go overboard into fascism in the name of security, never go out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And Two-Face fits into the role well, albeit a little unsubtly.
Yeah.
A politician is two-faced. Yeah. Do I have to draw you a map? There is an awful lot of rhetoric that could be put into the mouths of more than one party leader right now and not sound out of place from what Two-Face says. Croc is not the Croc of the original pre-crisis, but he hasn't been that for a while.
No, it's just who he is now.
Yeah. Ivy's great in this.
Yeah, and you were saying it's a testament to Batman's rogues gallery, how well they stand up once you take Batman out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
I think the book itself is a testament to just how good of a storyteller Cliff Chiang is, and kind of now that the dust has settled on this series, I don't know what he's doing, but he's essentially single-handedly created a modern masterpiece about a side character, giving them the spotlight. And again, it's a perfect representation of the right person telling the right story at the right time. It's very political about things that are still happening right now. And it's just everything about this just works.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just single-handedly done this. This should be on top 10 lists.
I hope that this becomes like New Frontier.
Yeah.
When we covered New Frontier... many, 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 many years ago, we're going to pat ourselves on the back. No one else was really talking about it. No one else had really latched onto it. Mm. And then over the years, not because of us, we're a very small cog, but other people independently went back to it and went, this is actually really good.
Yeah.
And over the years, it's grown in stature.
Well, I hope this happens here, because when this came out and when the trade came out, there was a lot of buzz from your typical reviewers, from your comic creators saying, read this book, this is... And it just seems to have quietened down a bit. This deserves that praise to still keep going.
I think so.
This is an evergreen one. This should be one of your little £10 mini ones that DC are releasing.
Maybe they'll get to that, but wouldn't they have to reformat the pages?
Well, yeah, that's your problem with this format as well.
It is, like you say, it's a modern masterpiece. Every character is fleshed out and fully rounded. The art is wonderful. However,
again, there's the caveat.
This entire story relies on that goddamn stupid internet meme that if Bruce Wayne only put his money into outreach programs, Gotham would be fine, which is bollocks on so many levels.
Yeah.
And easily disproved. But if that is indeed the premise of this story, then the story itself shows that it doesn't work. Because Batman exists because Gotham breeds a particular breed of criminal.
Yeah.
The Joker still exists if Bruce puts all his money into outreach programs.
Well, isn't it a Grant Morrison thing, is you can put all your money into charities as much as you want, but if Joker poisons the blood supply doing a gala charity event isn't going to save
Batman.
That. Yeah.
And some people will say, well, he doesn't become the Joker without being Batman. Fine, but that's still not going to be the same for everybody, is it? There's still going to be a killer croc. There's still these things breed in Gotham City. Two-Face still exists. Clayface, Croc, even Catwoman would possibly still exist without Batman.
Yeah.
So how would Bruce not being Batman and putting his money into improvements prevent anything?
But also, Batman, well, Bruce Wayne does do all these charities. It was really a question. DC recently printed the Ra's al Ghul Treasury facsimile edition, and rereading that quite recently was just refreshing to see, oh, Bruce Wayne funds all these charities. Yes. Bruce Wayne funds these schools and these orphanages, and it's a completely different Batman to what we've got now. And I think arguably, not to put all the blame on this, is when you get to the Ultimates and then the films adapting the Ultimates, is you have now superheroes who are, they have no secret identities.
Yep.
They are, you know, the superheroes, and they are also an extension of the military and the police. So now a lot of your people are used to these versions of the characters. And so it's very easy to say, well, why doesn't he do this? Well, because he does. Mm. They've just been transformed into these police figures rather than heroes that they used to be.
Yeah, he does do this. There's many, many examples of him doing just that. He has orphans. Charities for orphans. He has house building programs. He has college scholarships for people who work for him. These are commonly mentioned in different stories. If we ignore this incredibly misguided viewpoint, this is as good as year one.
Yeah.
Or Dark Knight. And you kind of have to roll with it. It shows the full range of a Black Label project.
Mm.
There are none of those irritating symbols or numbers to denote swearing.
Yeah, they just swear.
But they don't go overboard on it.
Yeah.
Have you seen a Tom King book recently where it is just literally full of question marks, exclamation points, hashes, hashes, asterisks, asterisks?
Right, yeah.
Every other line he's swearing, but he can't swear.
Right.
Because it's a regular book.
Yeah.
So to me, if I was writing that, I just wouldn't have them do it because I can't.
Yeah.
We've discussed this before. If you're going to do it, do it.
Yeah.
And if for whatever reason you can't do it, don't do it.
Well, it's kind of, we're reading Hellblazer at the moment, the Garth Dennis stuff for the upcoming episode. And the swearing in that is really good because it's natural swearing. He's writing real people having real conversations and like, oh yeah, they'll swear, but no more than you and your mates might do at the pub. And this is similar.
Yeah.
The language and the dialogue and the swearing in particular is written by someone who just naturally implements it into the language rather than a teenager who's learned those words for the first time and is thinking
and
of
puts
how
them in instead of
it.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where you would go like and like, they just swear.
Yeah.
Which is boring.
So this is just really well written, mature dialogue.
Yes. Yeah. Overall, ignore the bit about Batman doesn't do anything other than be Batman.
Yeah.
It's bollocks. Take that off the table. This is an exceptionally good series. Highly recommended. Yeah, I think you're right. I think when people are now going top 10 Batman books, I think this should be there. Even though it's not really a Batman book.
Even not necessarily in one of those top Batman books, but still, I think it's a shame that this kind of had its moment and then has just been largely swept aside. You know, if DC really do want to put more emphasis on the Black Label, then this should be pushed out there as well.
Yeah.
This is what the Black Label can do. For all of me taking the piss out of it earlier on, this is your adult book with these characters. This is your, you know, a story that is separate from your main timeline.
Yep.
This uses the square dimensions to its strengths. This is the perfect example of everything they wanted Black Label to be.
It's also a perfect example of everything that the more vocal and loud corners of the fan base want the comics to be.
Yeah.
But the thing is, now you've given it and they don't seem to want that.
No.
So what exactly is it you want that you've been given here? A genuinely mature and adult take on these characters that kind of embraces a little bit of the silliness while at the same time acknowledging that that silliness exists.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of a fault to its premise, but not so much that you can't ignore that to enjoy the story.
Mm.
But did it sell? I don't know.
I think it sold well. And it was, like I said, it was big. It had its moment. Mm. It was huge while it was running. And then when the trade came out, it drummed up all that excitement again. But then at the same time, you know, how excited can you stay about a title once it's been out and released into the wilds, you know?
They should do more promotion for these things once they become the inevitable hardcover and trade paperback.
Yeah, I think...
They don't seem to. They promote the shit out of issue one.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of gets forgotten, doesn't it?
But then we've been saying a lot, there was a lot of promotion towards your Scott Snyder and your Tom King stuff, but then nothing else.
Mm.
You've got things even that are currently coming out being swept under the carpet for the next big event and the next big... So how much of this is to do with it is intentionally not getting the attention it deserves, or how much of it is just a case of it's a victim of DC's system of rebooting constantly?
Mm.
You know, the 24-hour news cycle extends to comics as well to an extent.
Yeah. If you've not read it, we heartily recommend you go and pick it up, because it is genuinely very entertaining, as is Superman Space Age, Batman Dark Age, Batman First Night. They're the black label ones I've read.
The most recent ones, yeah. There's a new Zatanna one that has come out just this month, so I've got the first issue. I've not read it yet.
What size is it?
Normal.
Right. So it's not black label size.
No, it's not, but it is black label. It's just not black label size. But the artwork looks great inside. I'm very excited. That looks good.
Right. We'll close out with the last email we've got from Rob McCarthy, who's numbered them. I always like when they number them. Makes it easier to read. Number one, I don't know if this is universal, even in America, but every academic class I've taken on science fiction has studied The Prisoner, even more than Star Trek. I don't, oh, really?
Right, okay.
I know Buffy's well studied as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know The Prisoner was that well regarded in academia. Two, I guess if you're expanding the show, it has to be less surreal, because it's kind of hard to think of Number Six wondering what it was real for 20 years. Oh, I don't know. Having seen that last episode, most people wonder if that was real.
Yeah.
Number three, I think mostly the series treats the village as real, or can be read that way. I think the village was real. Four, but then if Fallout is real, the village blew up. Yes, it did. But I think that miniseries looked at Fallout as being a story told to us by an unreliable narrator.
Okay.
So there was elements that were true and there were elements that weren't true. Five, I think if some people wanted that what's real vibe that we got, but George Markstein kept pushing for it, it's really a place for captured spies. Well, that's probably why he got rid of Markstein in time for the last couple, which is a shame, because without Markstein, the scripts weren't as good. Number one, I never meant to imply you liked Highlander 2. It's really bad, but you said something like all movies get worse after part three. No, did I not say if you want a franchise, it's part three you've got to get right?
I don't know.
Because that's always been Goldfinger.
Right.
Perfected the Bond formula.
Yes, yeah.
Solidified its future. Superman 3, not so much.
And there was no future after
that. Well, there was Superman 4, but most people don't talk about that, even though I quite like it. Part two, PPS, I had machine guns on my wheelchair, but I can't talk about them. Damn lawsuits. Well, it's funny that he should say that, because Doctor Who ended with a guy in a wheelchair who had machine guns on his wheelchair. Well, it wasn't a wheelchair, it was one of those mobility scooters.
Right.
But surely the same thing would apply. It would just push you backwards. But you'd have brakes.
Well, no, because mobility scooters are heavier, aren't they?
Yeah, that's
true. Engine in there.
Yeah, that's true. On Earth One Superman, I know I didn't read it. Any new wrinkle on Superman is going to be some X-Men riff. I think we talked about that last time, didn't we? But I didn't understand why it was an X-Men thing. I didn't understand what you meant by that. So you can get to us if you want to. That's it for this time. We, Catwoman, Lonely City, heartily recommended. Go and pick it up next time. An all-new episode of Who Kicks Comics. What are we doing? Is it Hellblazer?
We're doing Hellblazer
to further our conversation about Vertigo / Black Label. Because it is a Black Label book, the omnibus.
It is.
So yours are Vertigo.
Yes.
Mine, a Black Label.
Well, I've got half and half.
Have you?
Because Ennis jumps on before it's Vertigo. In fact, what's really good about it, and what I absolutely love about reading those issues, it was the same with your Preachers and stories around that time, is the adverts.
Mm.
And a few months before it becomes Vertigo, with it's either the birthday issue or the one he goes to visit his sister. You've got adverts where it's like half the Vertigo logo saying, get excited, something's coming. And the further you progress, the more of the Vertigo logo you see. It's actually really exciting to see it in
isn't it
real time.
Just after that Fear and Loathing, it became Vertigo.
No, Fear and Loathing is Vertigo.
All right. So is it the issue before that it becomes Vertigo?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's great as well because it tells you at the end what issues are coming out at the time, and they're always kind of similar ones. So you get then this month's issue of Swamp Thing and this month's
They had like a bullpen bulletin, didn't they?
It's great. As nice
as Ledge, was it called?
Yes, yeah. Right. Over the edge.
Over the edge.
Over the edge. Yes. As much as, you know, your nice new hardbacks and collections are, I love reading Vertigo single issues just for the adverts and the Vertigo Over the Edge. And
I had to buy the omnibus because somebody left with my comics.
You gave them to me.
You're stealing me, that is.
So, you know, you gave them to me for safekeeping. I am keeping them safe from your dogs.
Yeah. It'd be nice if somebody did. So that's next time. We're going to blitz through every single issue of Hellblazer that Garth Ennis wrote as part of Vertigo, now Black Label. Okay. That'll be it for this time then. We'll see you next time. HeyKidsComic@virginmedia.com if you want to be like Matt and Rob and send us an email. And we'll be back real soon. Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to him. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/aleyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, coming in your ears. It's a date.